Welcome to Occult of Personality Podcast. Joining us once again is our good friend Mitch Horowitz. You can find his website at mitchhorowitz.com. And Mitch is from Tarcher Penguin Books in New York. And we've spoken to him several times in the past. Mitch, welcome back to the program. It's always good to speak with you.
Thanks. Likewise. Glad to be here.
Before we begin our conversation on today's topic, which is Colonel Henry Steele Olcott, I just wanted to ask you, do you have any books coming out that you'd like to speak about at all?
Yes, I do. I'm completing a book right now on the history of the occult in America. It's called Occult America, The Secret History of How Mysticism Conquered America. And it is going to be published by Bantam. And I'm actually just now in the final stages of completing it. It's been quite a ride, and I'm seeing the finish line in sight. And people can look for that from Bantam probably sometime in 2009.
Oh, excellent. And I believe we spoke about that a lot, actually, in Podcast 21.
That's right.
So if people wanted to check out that information, if they hadn't already heard it. Sounds excellent, and I know I'm looking forward to the book, and I'm sure a lot of other people are too.
Well, thank you. And yeah, we did talk about a lot of the themes together in podcast number 21, and it's been quite a ride writing this book. In some respects, it's been something that I've been working on for years, but in terms of the actual writing, I've committed about the last 3 years to it. So it's something that I've put a lot into, and I hope readers are going to really feel that it's a book that speaks to many, many different aspects of occult history in America that are all around us, but that have not gotten a fair inclusion into traditional works of history.
Mm-hmm. That's a very good way of putting it. Based on our conversations, I'm sure that the book will do that. So, in speaking of Colonel Henry Steele Olcott, he was such an amazing man, it's really hard to know where to begin. We know him in perhaps this context as the co-founder and first president of the Theosophical Society, but his life was so full of so many accomplishments, just amazing, really.
Yeah, he really was a remarkable figure. He was an unclassifiable figure. He was certainly the most prominent American figure to come out of the occult in the 19th century. And yet, there's no one descriptor that can capture who Henry Steele Olcott was as a man. If you travel to India, he is seen as a person who helped instigate the Hindu revival there and helped spearhead the earliest stages of the struggle for Indian independence. If you go to the nation of Sri Lanka, he is seen as a man who helped inspire a massive Buddhist revival throughout that entire nation of 20 million people. There are hundreds, literally hundreds of Buddhist schools today in the nation of Sri Lanka that owe their inception to Henry Steele Olcott. In America, he's thought of as everything from a religious innovator to a father of the alternative religious culture to a dupe of Madame Blavatsky, a man who had the wool pulled over his eyes by this foreign occultist from Russia. And if you look in other sources, Henry Steele Olcott is simply remembered as a man who was a investigator of military contractor fraud during the Civil War and one of the earliest investigators of the Lincoln assassination. That's just another fold of his career that many people don't know about. It's funny, I was just looking at a book earlier today It was published in the year 1959 by Prentice Hall Press. It's written by a historian named Theodore Roscoe. It's called The Web of Conspiracy. And it's the story of the assassination of Lincoln and the attempt to bring John Wilkes Booth and his co-conspirators to justice in the weeks and months that followed. So it's kind of a political potboiler that starts with the events of the assassination and then basically takes you through the history of the police investigation. Henry Olcott, who was one of the earliest investigators of the assassination, and I think made the first arrest of one of the suspected co-conspirators, is written about throughout this book. There is not a single mention anywhere in it of his activities as an occultist, no mention of theosophy, no mention of Madame Blavatsky, no mention of his travels throughout India, Sri Lanka, Burma, Japan, and he left a great mark on all those nations, helping to revive their traditional Buddhist and Hindu cultures. There's no mention of any of this. The historian actually seemed to have been unaware that Henry Still Olcott had this whole other career. He simply writes about him as a man investigating the Lincoln assassination. There are other quarters in which Henry Still Olcott is remembered as a great scientific agriculturalist. In the years immediately preceding the Civil War, the North was very concerned about replacing the sugarcane that it had grown very accustomed to importing from the South. As war came to seem like a greater and greater possibility, the North needed to devise substitutes for the crops that it depended on that were coming from Southern plantations. So Olcott, as a very young man, wrote a couple of highly influential books on sugar substitutes that could be imported from Africa and China. And he was considered, and remember at this time the United States was very much still an agricultural nation, he was considered one of the young stars of scientific agriculture. So you can go into all these different channels of history and you can find reasons why Henry Still Olcott would have been a very interesting man had he never met Helena Blavatsky. The fact that he did meet Helena Blavatsky, they both encountered one another at a farmhouse in Vermont around the year 1774. They were both at a farmhouse up in Chittenden, Vermont, where there were a couple of brothers with the name of Eddie who were conducting these trance medium sessions where they were supposedly conjuring up all kinds of ghosts and spirits and poltergeist activity. So Henry Olcott and Helena Blavatsky met at this rather dreary, supposedly haunted farmhouse up in Vermont, and his career takes a completely different direction. He becomes enchanted with the idea of the occult world. They return to New York City. They found the Theosophical Society in 1875. They attract members ranging from Thomas Edison to Abner Doubleday. And the society, though never quite finds its full footing in New York, and they relocate to India at the end of 1878, believing that the real rebirth of mystical traditions will be in the East. And Henry Olcott begins this completely new and different career, and that's what he's widely known for. But if that never happened, he would still appear in books like Web of Conspiracy. His ideas would still be studied by students of scientific agriculture. Anybody who was interested in learning about the problem of military contractor fraud during the Civil War, and apparently it was a very grave problem, would read about Henry Olcott as a prize investigator of military corruption and contractor fraud during the Civil War. He was named a staff colonel so that he could investigate instances of military contractors ripping off the Union Army. There would just be these various pages of history where Henry Olcott would appear, but the most fateful thing that happened to him was meeting Madame Blavatsky in 1874 at this farmhouse up in Vermont, returning to New York and founding the Theosophical Society with her. And as far as his career goes from that point, the Theosophical Society, I think, has touched every aspect of the alternative religious culture in the West and every aspect of the Buddhist and Hindu revivals in the East. I mean, we can talk more about that later in our conversation, but the breadth and extent of theosophy's influence on the world that we live in today is too rarely understood, is poorly understood. We would be living in a world that would look and feel different had it not been for the advent of theosophy.
That's for sure. So let's explore this a little bit more, his transforming of his life, because you're right, he was an amazing person. He was considered an agricultural expert as a young age. I think it was 26 years old, basically.
That's right. That's right.
All right. So as we explore his life and his interest in the esoteric side of things, prior to his meeting of Madame Blavatsky, what exactly was his interest and where does it come from?
Well, it's always an interesting question where the seeds seem to get planted for somebody's interest in esoteric or occult ideas. Olcott was born into a Presbyterian home in Orange, New Jersey in 1832. He had what would have been considered a very ordinary, somewhat well-to-do household in the Northeast. There was nothing in the slightest that anyone has found in connection with his parents or his siblings or his childhood that would have given hints to his further development. But something starts to change as he enters his teenage years. When Henry was 15 years old, he enrolled in New York University, or what was then New York University. It had a different name at the time. It was, I believe it was called University of the City of New York. Anyway, he remained at New York University for just 1 year. Apparently, his father's finances went bust, and Henry had to quit school after a year. We have very little information about that. Henry never wrote about that himself, but you can only imagine the agony that it must have been for a boy of 15, 16 years old to go off to college in New York City and then find that he could no longer return because his family's finances went bust. It must have been an agony. Mm. And at the age of 16, we have records that show that Henry went out to live with relatives in Ohio to try his hand at farming. Again, it's always helpful to remember that America was to the core an agricultural country in the mid-19th century. And if Henry couldn't go to college, and if his father's business interests had gone under, farming was really the career for a young man to get involved in. There weren't a great range of options even for a boy growing up near a city. So at about 16, in the year 1848, Henry packs up and goes to live with his maternal uncles at a farm in Ohio. He apparently discovers spiritualism among these relatives at that time. Spiritualism started with the wrappings at Rochester early in the year 1848. The news began to travel very quickly. It really just swept across America's cities and plains in the months following the Rochester wrappings as they were heard in upstate New York. For people who aren't familiar with that, there were two young girls by the name of Fox who lived in a small, rather dreary house in a hamlet near the city of Rochester, and spirit raps were heard throughout the house one night, and it enraptured first the family, then the entire neighborhood, then the media, and the concept of communication with the dead as something that was available to ordinary men and women became a sensation, almost like nothing the nation had ever seen before. So interest in spiritualism, within a period of a few months, had traveled out to Ohio just before the point where the frontier began. Henry was there. He said that his relatives were interested in this, and he began to develop an interest with them. He spent about 5 years in Ohio, so this was not an insubstantial part of his life. He really went from being a teenager to a young man in Ohio under this influence. Again, he says very little about it, but the fact that he spent about 5 years with these relatives and that these were such formative years in his life can give you a sense that coming in touch with that kind of influence at that age leaves a definite mark. Anyway, Henry came back east, and at that time, spiritualism was absolutely cresting in the 1850s. When Henry returned back east to the New York area, he worked on a variety of scientific farms. He became an agricultural journalist. But these were the heydays of spiritualism, and it was very ordinary for a well-read, thoughtful young man to come in touch with these currents. He also came in touch with Freemasonry, but I think Masonry for him was more of just a business connection, less of an esoteric connection. He wrote very, very little about it later in life. He mentions it only incidentally in his own memoirs. But one could make the case that being a Freemason may have saved Henry Olcott's life at a certain point. In 1859, he was writing as an agricultural journalist for the New York Tribune, but he wanted to branch out and cover political events, cultural events, so he prevailed upon his editor to permit him to travel down to Charlestown, Virginia, to cover the hanging of the abolitionist John Brown. This was in December of 1859. When he got down to Charlestown, Virginia, there was a lot of mob violence and hostility in the air. People were furious with the abolitionist forces that they felt were sympathetic to John Brown. The New York Tribune, for which Henry was writing, was widely known as an abolitionist newspaper, and he received physical threats. He was taken off a train at some point. His luggage was impounded. He was in fear for his physical safety at certain points while he was covering the hanging. After his luggage was impounded, he was afraid to go pick it up at a local courthouse because he thought he may very well have been arrested and possibly hanged with John Brown. There was just a feeling of violence in the air. He was able to find a local soldier who he discovered was a Freemason and prevail upon him in a spirit of Masonic fraternity and ask this man to go get his luggage from the courthouse and safely escort him out of this area, which this man did. So it's kind of extraordinary. You have this country where legal protections at that time were not what we expect them to be today, and relying on a Masonic fraternal connection could save your skin, and it certainly saved his skin. So we see this is the world he's coming from. He's coming from a world of spiritualism. He's coming from a world where he takes seriously Masonry. But in many respects, he's still a very mainstream, upstanding, respectable member of society. In 1860, he gets married to a woman named Mary Morgan, who was the daughter of an Episcopal minister. And they settle in for what seems like it's going to be a fairly ordinary life. But the Civil War breaks out, and Henry joins the Union Army. He's commissioned as a signals officer. And his military career, as we were discussing earlier in the conversation, it takes on a completely different life of its own. He becomes an investigator of military fraud. As I referenced earlier in the conversation, at the end of the war, he's conscripted to be one of the investigators of the Lincoln assassination. He plays a critical role in the early stages of the investigation. He was part of a three-man judicial committee that was trying to determine whether there was a vast conspiracy involved in the Lincoln assassination. Was this just a lone gunman? Was this just a collection of violent malcontents? Or was there a genuine conspiracy? Was this something that the Confederate Army had cooked up in its final days in the field? It was a time of tremendous tension and confusion. Henry Olcott made the first arrest of a co-conspirator in the assassination. He conducted early interrogations. He was a key part of the early team. When he left his commission as a colonel, he became a lawyer. He moved to New York. Again, you see Henry Olcott just going back into ordinary life. And it really looked at a certain point in his life around the late 1860s like this was a guy who was going to become probably a well-to-do New York City lawyer. He had lots of contacts from his days as an army colonel. People still called him the colonel. He still dabbled in journalism. He had a couple of kids. He was obviously seemed to be settling down into a rather ordinary, gentlemanly existence. But nothing in his life ever quite happens as it seemed planned. He was obviously restless, and his interest in spiritualism began to reassert itself. And it's very interesting when you look at the people's formative years, when you look at the influences in their lives, not just when they were very young, but when they were teenagers. What were their first intellectual awakenings? You can learn a lot about somebody. For Henry, his first intellectual awakenings involved spiritualism. He had to leave school. He had to go to work on a farm in Ohio, which may or may not have been his ideal career. And his form of leisure, of study, of inquiry, and of entertainment to a certain extent was spiritualism. So this reasserted itself later in life. He read in a spiritualist newspaper called Banner of Light in 1874 about the Eddy brothers up in Chittenden, Vermont. They were transmediums of a sort. They were, according to witnesses and observers, able to call up these different ghostly figures in the evening at their farmhouse. And lots of people from northern cities went and stayed up at the Eddy's farmhouse to investigate this, to observe this. It was like a kind of supernatural spa. When Olcott went up there, and he was on assignment from another New York newspaper, the New York Daily Graphic, he went up there in the late summer, early fall of 1874, he met Blavatsky. She had come to New York the year before. She was interested in spiritualism. Anybody who was deeply interested in spiritualism would find their way sooner or later to the United States at that time very often to New York and the surrounding areas, although spiritualism was certainly spreading out west as well. They met, and he just became absolutely enchanted. And he published a book in the year 1875 called People from the Other World. It was a journalistic investigation of spiritualism. The book holds up incredibly well. I mean, it's actually a tremendously enjoyable read. And Madame Blavatsky appears as a character in this book, People from the Other World. And reading it, you can just tell how enchanted he is with this mysterious Russian noblewoman who has visited the pyramids, who has been through the jungles of the Far East, who has studied Buddhism and Hinduism and all kinds of different tribal and traditional religions, who claims supernatural powers, who claims to have fought with Italian revolutionaries who were trying to wrestle Italy away from the last vestiges of papal control. You can tell he's just enchanted with this woman. This is his life beginning again. He had to leave college as a kid. He's found success in various ways, but he's obviously bored and restless. He was in the process already of divorcing his wife. Again, this is something else that he wrote very, very little about. People were very closed-mouthed about these things, and there are very few surviving records. But he was obviously going through some kind of a change or crisis or desire to turn a page in his life. And when he met this woman, it's as if his life was starting all over again. His friends and relatives thought he was out of his mind. How could he possibly take up this intimate friendship with a bizarre, eccentric, mediumistic, mysterious woman who claimed all kinds of supernatural powers and connections? But it's clear that when he met her, his life began anew. And when we're looking for a key to Henry's character, all of his accomplishments preceding that moment, they're all interesting, and they're all important, and they're all remarkable in certain respects. But it was that interest in spiritualism as a teenager that stayed with him. It never left him. And it's funny, you look at people's lives in the present, and sometimes somebody goes out and does something that seems so out of character to their friends or their family members, but it's not really out of character. You just have to understand the person better. You have to realize that sometimes the most significant influences on a person's life are not the ones that have been the longest influences, the most obvious influences, the most talked about influences. Sometimes there's just this certain something that clicked in their intellect or in their character when they were younger, and it determines what the rest of their future is going to be. And this for Henry was spiritualism. When he and Madame Blavatsky started the Theosophical Society the following year in 1875, there was just no looking back. It all just took on this remarkable life of its own.
Oh yeah, it's a nice hot summer's night out there. Driving's cool, traffic's clear. Yeah, this next one's from U2.
What are you doing? This isn't our show.
Right where you're sitting now, investigating subculture and counterculture, so you don't have to.
The occult, paranormal, fringe writers, counterculture,
underground music,
weird events,
conspiracy theories. Check sittingnow.co.uk for the latest episode.
A Cult of Personality podcast will return in just a moment after a brief intermission featuring a musical interlude by our friends from the Quiet Earth Orchestra. From your description, it seems like Olcott's life up until the point where he met Blavatsky was really just, it was all prelude to that point. I'm curious, as we sort of get into their relationship and theosophy, how long, if at all, do you think it was before he was told or realized Blavatsky's mission, as it were, if you know that's the term you want to use, I don't know, sort of her instructions from her masters, as she might have put it?
Yeah. Well, you see seeds of it very, very early on in their relationship. His book, People from the Other World, is a remarkable record because it's prior to their really becoming intimate collaborators. It's prior to the founding of the Theosophical Society. And even in that book, she discusses with him and he makes references to there being some order of great initiates who sent her to America. She maintained that spiritualism was this very shallow, degraded form of contact with what he would call the other world, and that she had been sent to America by an order of initiates, and the idea was that she was going to point to greater truths that spiritualism could only begin to guess at. And she was very mysterious about all this, but there were certain references to it. And toward the end of People from the Other World, he just ponders in print, well, there were moments where he actually was prone to believe this, that there was an order of great initiates somewhere that had sent her to America or that maybe were directing the events of spiritualism from behind the scenes. There are all kinds of stories that have made their way into the lore around theosophy and spiritualism, that there was a hidden hand at work that was using spiritualism as a way of opening the West to mystical ideas once again. And Olcott makes these allusions very, very early on. It starts to happen almost right away. As Olcott and Blavatsky return to New York City in May of 1875, he receives one of his first letters from the Mahatmas, or the Hidden Masters, these great initiates who are capable of existing both on our physical plane and on higher planes of existence, according to the mythos and lore around their existence. He starts to receive his first letters addressing him as Brother Neophyte, seemingly inviting him into this inner circle of humanity that is going to be trained in mystical truths that the West and other great civilizations once understood and have now lost. And he takes to this. He takes to this. You know, it's interesting because here was a man who was a military investigator. He was known as an unimpeachable witness. He was considered, in fact, this book I was describing earlier, Web of Conspiracy, the author of that book takes the time to reprint a transcript of Henry Olcott's interrogation of one of the suspected co-conspirators in the Lincoln assassination because he felt it was a prime example of police interrogation tactics from that particular era. So here's Henry Olcott, who is considered this hard-headed, impeccable investigator of military fraud, of corruption, of the Lincoln assassination, and he has the instincts of an investigator. And yet he's receiving this supernatural material, and he believes in its authenticity. Now, one group of people, one group of critics will say, well, it's just testimony to what a poor lost soul Henry was. There's this popular notion that Henry Olcott was just having the wool pulled over his eyes by this con artist. Well, that's an opinion that's out there. It's defensible. You can talk about it. It's not hard to believe it. On the other hand, Henry went through many different investigations. He fancied himself a police official. He fancied himself an investigator of fraud. He fancied himself a journalist. He fancied himself a lawyer. For him, the process was a very rational one. He tried to discount all kinds of possibilities. He tried to come at the question of spiritualist phenomena and these supernatural letters and contacts from the great masters from all different skeptical positions. And he kept coming back around to the feeling that this material was authentic. So whatever a person makes of Henry Olcott's character, he experienced this material as authentic. And I would think that even his most ardent critics believed he was a man of sincerity. They might have said he was delusional, but he was a sincere man. people reserved all their hostilities and bric-a-bats for Blavatsky. She was supposed to be the one who was pulling strings from behind the scenes. Henry was sincere. He was just deluded, according to his sharpest critics. So I think the record shows no reason to doubt Henry's sincerity. He experienced these things as real. Now, he and Blavatsky spent a tremendous amount of time together. They were inseparable. They shared apartments together. And eventually, in 1876, they moved into an apartment together on the west side of Manhattan that was jokingly called the Lamasery. And the Lamasery became this place where it was an occult salon for all of New York City. Anyone who was interested in the occult, anyone who cared about these ideas, sooner or later found their way to the Lamasery, where they would have all kinds of discussions and arguments and seances and debates. And this was the central meeting place for intellectuals, literary figures, artists, people from different walks of life who were interested in spiritualism and the occult. It was a great center of New York life at that time. Henry recounts a story in his diaries, also very, very readable documents, where sometime in 1877, late in the evening, after Blavatsky had gone to bed, when he and Blavatsky had been working on her book, Isis Unveiled, and they worked late into the night, she went to sleep, he was up, he was reading, he was smoking a pipe. He recounts this story in great vivid detail of being visited by one of the great masters, Master M, or Master Moria, who phenomenally appeared from out of nowhere in his apartment and was standing over him. And he was this splendid Hindu figure, turban, standing 6'7", and he counseled Henry as a father would a child, explaining to him that he was under the tutelage of this great lodge of initiates, and they were placing great faith in him and wanted him to know that he was considered a neophyte of tremendous value to them. And as quickly as the man seemed to appear from out of nowhere, he disappeared. Henry wrote about this with tremendous vividness. Again, he had the mind of an investigator. In his diaries, he provides the blueprint of the apartment almost as if he's mapping out a crime scene. He tries to discount every possibility. He comes to the conclusion that this phenomenally appearing great master, this turbaned man, was real. Somehow, he appeared in his Manhattan apartment and counseled him and spoke to him and reassured him. And this great master, at the end of their conversation, Henry records, removed his turban, placed his turban on the table, and he wanted to leave this with Henry as a token of the realness of this visitation. Now, of course, contemporary men and women hear this story, just as men and women did at that time, and they roll their eyes and they think, it's ridiculous. It sounds on the face of it like Henry was just the poor victim of one of Madame Blavatsky's tricks. And this is evidence of a man who was either suffering from a crippling naivete, you know, hallucinations, or who was dreaming, or who had fallen asleep, or who was drunk. There are 101 conventional reasons why it would seem that poor Henry had lost his mind. But to him, this encounter was real. He wrote about it with the unique vividness that you will find in no other piece of metaphysical literature of that day. One of the things I've found is that when people are making something up, when people are kind of pulling your leg, their writing is boring. Insincere writing is boring writing. Many of the copycat accounts of people being visited by great masters that spun off from Henry's story and that began to become rife in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, they're dull, they're tedious, they're vapid, they're shallow. You're turning the pages and you're saying, I don't believe this and I don't really care. Obviously not everyone had that response, but as a 21st century reader, that's often my response. This story is different. Insincerity is boring. Sincerity is interesting. Henry wrote this story with a vivid sincerity. And anybody can read it. You can download a copy of the first volume of Henry's diaries online. You can buy them. They're called Old Diary Leaves. They make wonderful reading. It's a 6-volume set. The first 2 volumes are especially good. It's a tremendously vivid, involving story that is different in many degrees from the metaphysical literature that would follow it. This was obviously being written at the hand of somebody with a careful, detailed mind who believed that something fantastic had happened to him. Now, the question of the existence of the great masters or Mahatmas, the great adepts, great initiates, the great white brotherhood, the great lodge, they go under all these different names. has spawned an enormous literature, an enormous controversy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've spoken about this before, actually, yeah.
Yeah, and whatever your position, whatever your outlook, whatever your point of view is, you can find variants of it within that vast literature.
Right.
Henry believed. Henry had contemporaries who believed. I'll say this. If this man was delusional, if this man had grown soft in the head, if he had lost control of some of his vital faculties, well, one need only turn the page and look at the story of he and Blavatsky traveling to India in 1878. And their activities there, his political activities, his establishment of Buddhist schools, his role in helping to inspire the independence movement in India, his role in helping to inspire the Hindu and Buddhist revivals in India, Burma, Sri Lanka, in Japan, is absolutely extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
And these things are all part of a public record. His activities were being covered by the press. He was lobbying in London on behalf of Buddhist interests in Sri Lanka. He was trying to get British colonial authorities to relax some of their restrictions on Buddhist observance in Sri Lanka. This was a man of the highest effectiveness. I'm not arguing for or against one position or another. I'm just saying that anybody who thinks that Henry Olcott was some kind of a poor sucker who lost his mind somewhere on the west side of Manhattan after meeting Blavatsky doesn't know the record, because the record is very difficult to classify. Whether or not one places any stock whatsoever in his stories, he clearly believed them, and he went on to a career of such political effectiveness that even if there were no supernatural stories involved, you would still have to rub your chin and sort of marvel at how this man, who had never had a college education, was able to travel to a far eastern continent where he had no particular command of the language, he had no particular command of the local culture, he had very little to support him, it was just he and Blavatsky more or less on their own for the first couple of years, and somehow he and she together and the force of their character, the force of their vision, the force of their personas were able to attract a mass political following. It is a story more incredible than anything you'll find in fiction.
Yeah.
And there is no neat little box that it can be put in. The box just isn't there.
Well, I believe his story. You know, I've spoken about Ascended Masters before. I am of the opinion that this is a valid phenomena,
mm-hmm.
and can be perceived in physical ways very often by people who are in touch with these beings, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And I've spoken to other people who, you know, again, like you say, are what I would consider to be very intelligent, discerning, and not easily drawn in by any sort of chicanery or charlatans.
Mm-hmm.
And they all have a similar opinion of the way this works. And I think you're right. It has spawned a lot of material that's rather questionable. And in my opinion, it's not so hard to discern that the real from the not so real, if you will.
Yeah. You know, I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No, go ahead.
Did you want to say? You know, it's interesting. You know, apropos of your point, the character of the witness in these instances, to me, is very, very important.
Mm-hmm.
If I encounter a person who seems to meet a wide-ranging criteria and they are declaring themselves a witness to this kind of phenomena, I really start listening. The literary critic Harold Bloom has written a lot lately on Gnosticism, New Age, esoteric spirituality, and in some quarters he's thought of as a critic of these things, and yet he's not quite the critic that people often think. There's a great, great vein of sensitivity in Bloom's work for the esoteric, if you look for it. And he makes a point that I'm touched by in one of his recent books, where he's writing about Gnosticism, Kabbalah, and the literal existence of angels. And the point that he makes is that there seemed to be a time when supernatural visitations reached people who were just enormous personalities, people of remarkable personal strength. In antiquity or late antiquity, he cites the prophet Muhammad. In the modern era, he cites the Mormon prophet Joseph Smith, of whom he thinks very highly. And Bloom writes in one of his recent books, the point at which he turns off is when these stories start getting repeated by people who seem unremarkable. Because why would the great adepts or angels or some sort of supernatural powers reveal themselves to the unremarkable? Now, I'm not entirely sure whether I agree with that point, because you could say that Edgar Cayce was an unremarkable man, and yet I think his psychical gifts were just extraordinary. But if one is willing to take Bloom's point and kind of play ball with it a little bit, Olcott and Blavatsky were remarkable, and people around them were remarkable. Their circle of friends, allies, supporters, interlocutors ranged from W.B. Yeats to, in the case of Blavatsky, at the end of her life, Mahatma Gandhi. That doesn't mean that W.B. Yeats and Mahatma Gandhi followed everything that these people said with absolute devotion. They were friends and they were critics. But the fact that those were the kinds of circles that they were running in should not be ignored. These were people who were in touch with a remarkable group of interlocutors who took their experiences very, very seriously. Now, the great Hindu scholar and sage, Sri Aurobindo, who was a contemporary of Gandhi's, he's on record in one of his memoirs as saying that he, at a certain point, was visited by the theosophical master K.H. or Kuthumi, and that he asked Kuthumi to take him as a student, and Kuthumi said, no, you have another master. Aurobindo related this with absolute credulity, and it's difficult for we in America to understand the eminence of an intellect and of a figure like Sri Aurobindo in the Hindu world. I guess there's really no one in the West to whom Aurobindo could be compared, but in terms of fame and eminence, it would be a little bit something like Billy Graham here in America saying, oh yes, it so happens I was visited by Master Kuthumi too. You know, this is just a figure who occupies the firmament of India's religious life. And it's difficult to convey to Westerners the seriousness and the depth of a political and religious career like the one that was conducted by Sri Aurobindo. If Sri Aurobindo is recounting this experience, and if a person takes the trouble to learn who Sri Aurobindo was and to learn of his great significance in the Hindu world, that would be enough to give any critic pause. That would be enough to make anyone say, there's a question there. There's a really interesting question there. So when I read the theosophical literature about the Mahatmas, that literature has a way of following you. You know, I sometimes am ready to say, no, I don't believe it. They've gone too far this time. I don't believe it. Then I'll have the experience of reading an account like Sri Aurobindo's, and I'll say, you know what? There's no box I can put this in. This is a great modern mystery. And that's why theosophy won't go away in our culture. Every time we want to wash our hands of it and declare it something that belongs to medieval superstition, it keeps reasserting itself, and it keeps reasserting itself. These stories have no easy endpoint. They leave us with a mystery. And there's a certain point at which I think you just bow your head in respect towards some of this material and say, we can't speak of that which we don't know.
Yeah, it's difficult for people who haven't experienced this, I think, to have any sort of concept of what is actually occurring, let alone people who are experiencing it. Because contact with the divine is not always a simple and easy thing to understand.
No, it's not. And it can't be explained by the forensics that we like to use in modern life. You know, we think that, you know, you lay something out on a table, you dissect it, you pick it apart. Yes, you can get a lot of answers that way, and thank God those methods are available to us. Thank God that kind of inquiry is available to us. But these kinds of experiences, they're very quiet and they're very mysterious, and they don't lend themselves to that kind of forensic dissection.
Exactly. Now, for people who may not be familiar, let's talk a little bit just about the Theosophical Society and their purpose was and is. Obviously, it's derived from Eastern mystical or religious sources as opposed to, you know, what we would consider the classical Western esotericism. But what was the sort of overall, if we could encapsulate its philosophy, what would you say?
Well, I think it wanted to disassemble this artificial separation that exists among the religions. It had an ideal of universal brotherhood. It had an ideal of religious commonality. It had an ideal that there was an esoteric truth running through all the world's great religions, and that the divisions that man had created among them were artificial. And it wanted to revive a sense that the magical tradition, the esoteric tradition, the mystical tradition, the events surrounding spiritualism and other supernatural philosophies deserved inquiry, deserved experimentation, deserved legitimate, intelligent searching and seeking and questioning. When the society began, it was more Western-oriented in nature. It was very oriented towards the spiritualist culture, although it believed spiritualism was a very shallow well that hadn't been properly understood in America and in the West. It believed that spiritualism debased the spiritual search into kind of showmanship. Maybe there was authenticity to it, but it didn't really get to the ultimate questions. To reach the ultimate questions, you had to go back to the Egyptian traditions, the great esoteric traditions that lay at the heart of the world's religions. Early in its history, theosophy, through the agency of Henry Olcott and Madame Blavatsky, began to orient itself more toward the East. I think they came to believe, and they were advised by their Mahatmas, that the mystical opening that the world needed was more likely to occur in the East than in the West. They traveled to India. They began to grow more oriented towards Hindu and Buddhist ideas. In fact, in 1880, Olcott and Blavatsky became probably the first Western Caucasians to take formal Buddhist vows, which they did in the nation of Ceylon, which today we call Sri Lanka. It was a tremendous experience for people who were living under the colonialism of the British Empire to see these two Westerners come to their cultures, to their nations, and say, you have a magnificent history, you have a magnificent religious culture that the colonial occupier doesn't understand, and this needs to be revived. We need to open schools, we need to get young people involved in this tradition again. And this message was ready to be heard because colonialism was in its final decade, and some of the movement toward home rule was already underway by the time Blavatsky and Olcott arrived in Asia. But their sense of timing was just extraordinary. And they would have pointed out, well, you can thank our Mahatmas, you can thank our masters, because it's under their direction that we undertook this trip. And so when they reached Indian soil, they became very oriented toward Hinduism, toward Buddhism, not exactly leaving or walking away from Western esotericism. Olcott still spoke quite frequently about the occult tradition and considered himself part of it, as did his contemporaries. But they immersed themselves in the Eastern traditions. And Olcott, for example, produced in 1881 a Buddhist catechism that he thought could help reintroduce young people in Ceylon to Buddhism. And it's extraordinary, but that Buddhist catechism that Olcott wrote is still used to this day in class forefather of the Buddhist revival that started to sweep through that country well over a century ago. So theosophy can be seen as an occult organization. Theosophy can also be seen as a political organization. It played both roles in the world. And Mahatma Gandhi, who, by the way, was given the name Mahatma by Madame Blavatsky's successor, Annie Besant, she was drawing upon the use of the term Mahatma as it was used in theosophy. It means great soul. And she applied that name to Gandhi, and that's the term. Most people think that's his first name. Of course, his first name is Mohandas, but his honorary title, Mahatma, is how he's known all over the world. That comes from theosophy. Now, he was involved with theosophy when he was a young man studying to become a lawyer in London, starting in 1889. Gandhi very openly credits theosophy with inspiring him to return to the Bhagavad Gita and the other great Hindu literature, which sent him on his journey of rediscovery into Hinduism. Gandhi very openly credits the principles of theosophy with getting him interested in the idea that there could be a caste-free, universal society where every person, every religion was considered equal. Now, Gandhi did very briefly join theosophy. It was not a lifelong affiliation for him, and he very shrewdly navigated his way around theosophy because there was a lot of organizational intrigue that he wanted no part of. But in several places, in his own memoirs, in authorized biographies, in letters that he wrote to Indian newspapers, he very forthrightly identifies theosophy as a primary inspiration for him when he was young. Now, if one takes a look at some of the prevailing literature, in some biographies of Gandhi, that gets written out. And that's a great loss, because that's writing out part of our culture as a world people. That's writing a seminal part of late 19th and 20th century history out of the textbooks, so to speak. Gandhi was responsible for making India into what is the largest democracy in the world today. The fact that he was inspired by theosophy should not be overlooked. That's important. That's one of the things I'm writing about in my book. We overlook these things, and we overlook them long enough to the point where they start to get treated like they belong on the margins of history. They don't belong on the margins of history. They're tremendously important to the world that we live in today.
Absolutely. So obviously the influence of Olcott and Blavatsky and the society that they created and sustained for so long, very, very far-reaching, and the impacts are felt by millions, if not billions, of people all over the world.
Yeah, it's just extraordinary. It's just extraordinary. And one of the things that gets me is, you know, you can't turn on the History Channel or one of the other cable channels today without at some point seeing a documentary about Hitler and the occult. Everyone seems to know something about Hitler's involvement with the occult.
Mm-hmm.
I'm somewhat a skeptic of that, and maybe at another time you and I can have a different conversation about that, but it says something about our perverse fascination with the Third Reich that everyone walking around seems to know something about Hitler's involvement with the occult, as if that's a given. People know nothing about Gandhi's involvement with the occult. Here was one of the great humanitarians of the 20th century, a man who has placed a positive influence on one of the most populous nations in the world. His influence has helped create greater stability in our world today. If India was not a democracy, we would be looking at a different world today. Through his sacrifices, through his influence, he nurtured a democratic spirit in the Indian independence movement. And I'll say it again, he very forthrightly identified theosophy as being a terrific influence on him when he was a young man.
Yeah.
Martin Luther King cited Gandhi as a primary influence on him when he was a young man. King was tremendously aroused not only by the idea of nonviolence as practiced by Gandhi, but he was aroused by Gandhi's idea of universal brotherhood.
Mm-hmm.
So the ripple effect from the revolution that Blavatsky and Olcott started is really considerable. And it gets brushed aside. And it gets brushed aside because people don't have a proper box in which to place the supernatural aspects of theosophical history. So they conclude, it must all be nonsense. Phooey, now we're done with it. Well, to Gandhi, it wasn't nonsense. And that is a gap in our history.
Well, that's an interesting point you bring up. And I agree with you in regards to the history glossing over the positive influences of occultism or esoteric thought. Unfortunately, I think that's by design. But there is this sort of philosophy, and this goes right back to Master Kuthumi himself, I think, whereby things considered like lower status, like you mentioned, the spiritualism or mediumship or things like this, or even the charlatans and the tricksters and the people out there who claim to know or be able to do things that they really couldn't, were out there as protection for the true adepts. Because if people actually thought that all of this was real, that the true adepts would not have the solitude or the peace with which they needed to proceed with their work.
Mm-hmm.
Which, again, people claim that's really just a very clever sort of argument to excuse it all, but there may be some truth to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, the effectiveness of theosophy as an organization, both spiritually and politically, is indisputable, and that should give anybody pause to look at the background story, to try to disassociate the background story of theosophy from its effectiveness in the world. That's not good historiography. You've got to look at both sides of that coin. And it may mean that things that we thought were comfortably settled, like the spiritualist era being a bunch of nonsense, are not so comfortably settled. Because the worldly influence of theosophy is evidence of something remarkable within that organization and within the lives of Henry Olcott. This all began with a discussion of a 15-year-old kid who had to drop out of New York University because his father's finances went bust. And he had to go out and farm with his relatives in Ohio because he apparently didn't face many other options. Those are very ordinary roots. And what grew out of those are so remarkable that I can't think of any opera, I can't think of any story of any great person striding the world stage, from Moses to Napoleon, that fully surpasses the unusual qualities of the life that belonged to Henry Still Olcott.
Yeah, it's truly, truly amazing. You said he went from the humble beginnings to someone who helped change the world in a lot of ways.
Yes.
Wow. Well, that's seems like a perfect way to wrap up here. I want to thank you again, Mitch Horowitz. Before we close out, do you have any final thoughts about either Henry Olcott or anything else that you'd like to mention?
Well, the only thing I would add about Olcott is that when he left behind him a tremendous record of memoirs, articles, diaries, he was written about a great deal, and you do get a feel for the man's character from the record that he left behind, and you get a feel for the man's character from what was written about him. Theosophy had very sharp critics, but even the sharpest critics would usually pause and say, there was something about this man that seemed sincere. He seemed to touch anyone who was around him by his earnestness. And there was something in the character of Henry Olcott that I think is the best of what it can mean to be an American, to be a searcher, to be somebody who is interested in and engaged in the world and who looks upon people around the world with a certain civic beneficence, a curiosity, a neighborliness. He represents a certain slice of America that is the best of what we are. There was a great earnestness in the character of this man, and I think that too must have had something to do with the effectiveness of Theosophy as an organization. He brought principles and ideals and sincerity into Theosophy, into its occult and political activities that represented the very best of where he came from. And I think part of the reason that we've heard of Henry Still Olcott, aside from everything that we've been discussing over the past hour, is that he was a man of good character, and that brought a certain firmness to everything that he did. And anybody who reads Henry's memoirs or any of the material that he left behind or reads what was written about him will get a sense of that. There was something of moral substance to this man, and the occult in the popular mind has all kinds of dark associations. People think of the word as having a sinister connotation. People associate it with figures from Rasputin to Aleister Crowley, who take on all kinds of sinister dimensions in the public mind. Olcott was a great historical figure who played against type. There was none of that in his life, even in the eyes of his sharpest critics. And that's worth pondering as well. Studying the life of Henry Still Olcott can challenge all kinds of prejudices, received opinions, and ideas about occultism, about the Western esoteric tradition, about how supernaturalism played itself out in the worlds of the 19th and 20th centuries. And this is why he was such an unclassifiable man. And he was a man of such ethical character that I think that, too, played a role in his greatness. It was his warmth. It was something about his ethics, his earnestness, his sincerity that made him a great man of his time. So I wanted to just say a word about my sense of his character in addition to the other material that we've been discussing.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. And I think those are all very valid and important points to think about, because you're right, he definitely sort of goes against the grain in a lot of respects. And I really want to thank you for spending the time with us to help us get to know him a little bit better, because he is somebody who is, you know, well worth knowing. A truly great soul.
Yes, I think those words are well chosen.
So thank you again, Mitch Horowitz. Your website is mitchhorowitz.com, and we look forward to speaking with you again in the future.
Thank you. I look forward to it too.